Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, это Prevail. И ваш ведущий Грег Олье.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. This is already somehow the 15th episode of the podcast. And I think now we can go back and sort of certain themes are beginning to emerge. Last week we had Victor Rudd, expert on Ukraine. We talked all things Ukraine. The week before that we had Jameson Firestone, who was Bill Browder's attorney and Sergei Magnitsky's boss. So we talked all things Russia and Putin. There's definitely an eye on foreign policy, foreign affairs, other countries, corruption overseas that affects the United States, and corruption and thievery that takes money out of the system here and denies us, we the people, we taxpayers, things that we do actually have the resources to have and enjoy. Healthcare, for one thing, college tuition. There's lots of things that we could have in this country that we are denied and we're told that we can't afford it. And we can. And the reason that we quote unquote can't afford stuff is because money is offshore and there's this second economy, as LB, my friend Lincoln's Bible, calls it, the second economy, the underworld economy, which if it was a country would be the fourth largest economy in the world, if not larger than that. And that money is just offshore. It's off the books. We don't know about it. Oliver Bulow wrote in Moneyland, which is a fantastic book about all this stuff, that money that goes offshore is money that's either gotten illegally or that people are just ashamed of where they got it from. Either they're boosting it from some other country or they acquired it illegally, or maybe they're trying to hide the money away from the tax man in their own country of origin. One of the places that is known for that, probably the preeminent tax haven in the world, is the island of Jersey. Now, a few weeks ago, I had Stuart Sivray on the show. He's the dissident activist in Jersey, formerly a senator there, and was forced out of his job and keeps being harassed and thrown in prison for telling the truth about what's going on there in terms of tax haven stuff and financial shenanigans, and in terms of the massive child sex scandal that racked that island and was covered up and continues to be covered up. So my guest today is the investigative journalist, Leah McGrath Goodman. She wrote a piece about Jersey called The Queen, the Heiress, and the Trillion Dollar Island in Institutional Investor magazine, which I encourage everybody to read. It's really good and interesting about some of the shenanigans that happened there with money laundering. Now, she also was the executive producer of the BBC documentary about the child sex scandal, which is just an atrocity, really, and which is still being covered up there. Nobody in power in Jersey wants anything bad that's ever happened in Jersey to be reported on or to come to light. Which, when you consider that the person ultimately in charge of everything that goes on in Jersey is Queen Elizabeth II, is kind of a problem. You know, we see her as this kind of friendly lady, always very well dressed, given that little wave that she does, but for her not to be aware, especially now, of what's gone on in Jersey, boggles the imagination. It really strains credulity to think that she really doesn't know what's going on in her crown dependency. This is her possession, this island, and she has people in charge there that bring money in for her, I guess, and I don't know. It's an ugly situation, but it's interesting and it's important that we know about these things because, again, as I said at the beginning, money whisked out of our country. It's stolen from places like Russia and Ukraine and Angola, hidden away, but it's also taken out of this country. Sometimes it's legal, you know? It's a tax shelter, but that doesn't make it right. The wealthiest billionaires in the United States increased their wealth some staggering proportion. I don't have the math in front of me. It's an astonishing amount of money just during the last year, just during the pandemic. And the idea that the United States cannot afford to pay for a healthcare system, a universal healthcare system for its citizens, when every other westernized country does this, is just nuts. It's crazy. And I don't think we're looking at it properly because it's not just people going into debt, although that's also awful. It's not just that the government's job is to defend its people. And, you know, it doesn't say defend against foreign powers necessarily. Why can't it defend against germs and viruses? Isn't that also part of the job of establishing a common defense? But not only that, it stifles entrepreneurship. How many people stay in jobs that they don't like, don't launch businesses that they think they can succeed only because they need the health care provided by their employer? Why do we want that kind of system? It's a crazy system. If we had even a baseline universal health care system in this country, we'd see a boom of entrepreneurship. New companies would open up, wages would increase without Bernie yelling about it because they'd have to pay more wages because they're not, you know, offering health benefits. And people will move jobs more often unless the jobs pay enough to make it worthwhile. So it just would be a force multiplier of good. But we're told, no, we can't afford it. No, it's too expensive. The thing to do is to cut taxes on the billionaires who are already boosting money and hiding it away in places like Jersey. So we're going to talk to Leah McGrath Goodman about that. Now, she's written a bunch of other things that are interesting, and we cover a lot in our talk. We went a little bit over, but that's okay. We talk about, she's written a new book about Arianna Huffington, so we talk about that a little bit. She wrote a book about oil and oil trading, and there's this weird thing that happened in oil trading last year towards the beginning of the pandemic, when the price of a barrel of oil was a negative amount of money. So we talk about that because that's obviously weird and something was amiss there. And then at the end, we talk about Bitcoin because she wrote years ago, which I didn't realize, she wrote an article for Newsweek where she speculates and does reporting kind of suggesting that the founder, the establisher of Bitcoin was in fact a guy named Satoshi Nakamoto, American man of Japanese descent living in California. So that was a really cool article. So I like to talk about or ask people about Bitcoin because I don't understand it. And I feel like it's important that we all sort of wrap our heads around it. I don't know if it's going to be gone in a year, like the tulips, or if it's here to stay. But either way, I think, you know, I personally want to know about it from people that have thought about it more than I have. So we talk about that at the tail end too. So without further ado, here is Leah McGrath Goodman. We'll be right back.
This episode of Prevail is brought to you by the Banker to Bada Bing, Jersey's best financial services firm. Need some wise guys to sit on your board of directors? Bada Bing can help. Worried about some rival Goomba stealing your crypto wallet? Bada Bing offers the best security this side of Le Havre. Don't want your ex-wife to take the Botticelli in the divorce? Sorry, honey, that painting got sold. Whether you're establishing a shell corporation, registering a ship, or parking the loot you won last weekend in Granville, come to the Jersey Shore. The Jersey Offshore. Bank of the Bada Bing. Protect your money the Jersey way. Member FDIC my ass. And now, back to the show.
Leah McGrath Goodman, hello.
Hello.
So New York City is now open. I was down there this weekend, and my observations were there's a lot of people, and without the mask, the pungent scent of urine is even more prominent than, or actually exactly as prominent as how I remembered it when I lived there. So what's going on?
Yeah, I think you're just used to that fresher country air where you
I
are.
Am, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, pungent scent of urine has always been a proud staple of New York in the summer.
And the winter and the fall and the spring as well. No, it's like when I leave my house for any length of time, if I go to Europe for a week and I come back, I'm like, oh my God, it smells like a menagerie in here because we have a small house and three cats and a guinea pig. But then 20 minutes later, I don't smell it anymore. So it's, you know, it's similar with New York. You just inure your body to these kind of things. But
totally. You always got to bring an umbrella out in the summer in New York because all of those thousands of air conditioners are dripping throughout the city wherever you go. Remember that?
I do, but I never carried an umbrella because if it started raining magically, dudes would show up selling umbrellas for $3, like no matter where you were in the city. And I don't know if that's still a thing. Like I didn't see a lot of cabs in the city. Like it felt like there weren't enough cabs.
No, really?
Yeah, I don't know. Is that a thing now? Like there's too many Ubers and Lyfts and bikes. I don't get this bike thing.
Well, the bike thing I think came about because there are so many more bike paths now, which I love. I brought my bike, so I'm very much enjoying it. Hey, I have a quick question about the umbrellas though for you.
Okay.
So in your time, did they sell the $3 umbrellas? In my time, it was like $5 at least, or even more. And did they always have that hideous claw, like? It was like a pointy claw end to the umbrella where the hand, it's like a terrible claw handle. It looks like a Captain Hook hook.
Yeah, but it has a purpose because the claw, if I have my bag around my shoulder, I can hang the umbrella from the claw onto the strap of the bag. That's what it's for. So
you did the claws. I felt like it was like a murder weapon.
It probably, there's the over under on times it has been used as a murder weapon in New York City is what, 12? I don't know. Higher, lower?
There would be at least some incidents recorded, no doubt.
Yeah, yeah. There were actually, to answer your question, which you did not expect an answer to, there were two kinds of umbrellas. The little shitty ones were $3, and you could get a bigger, more elaborate one for $6, I think. That's how it
works. Oh, wow. I don't remember us having the elaborate option.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was elaborate. It was just bigger, and therefore it broke in the wind faster.
I know. But really, the small one is the way you want to go, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially in the Northeast.
Or not to have it at all. You just go underground and you got to know your way around. And again, it brings us back to where are all the cabs? They seem to have vanished. Okay. maybe not. I don't know. New York is always changing and that's part of what makes it great, but it's also part of what makes it frustrating because none of my landmarks are all gone. They're all gone. It's like, it might as well be in Chicago. You know, it just doesn't.
I'm sorry. Okay. In our minds, we all have like a long list of beautiful restaurants we've eaten at that are gone forever. And no one, I was with a friend the other day and we mentioned this little French bistro we used to love that had an outdoor garden with an overgrown grapevine and it's gone. And that was where I had escargot for the first time. And I was like, I'll never be able to eat there again. Cause I mean, it just vaporized. You can't even see it. And that's like so many places you love in New York. It's like they're gone from the face of the earth, but they live on in your mind. And it just tortures you, right? Cause you're like, if only I could just go back there.
I know. And then, but there are places that endure. Anyway, enough about New York. Let's talk about another corrupt place. Now, I was introduced to your work through Stuart Sivray, who's the activist and dissident from Jersey. And he's been a guest here on Prevail. So listeners who have listened to all, this is now what, episode 14, 15, something like that, are familiar with Stuart and what happened to him on the island of Jersey. He helped expose the child sex scandal there. And you've been covering that story for a long time. You were the executive producer of the BBC documentary about the scandal, which was called Dark Secrets of a Trillion-Dollar Island, Garen, colon, Garen. That's the, Garen is the name of the orphanage. Is that what it is? Or is it the-
Yeah, the orphanage is called Hotel La Gara.
Yeah. And you wrote more recently a fantastic piece for Institutional Investor about the offshore shenanigans on the island called The Heiress, the Queen, and the Trillion-Dollar Island, which I read that now. First of all, excellent article, really well written. Yeah. Your stuff in general is very storytellingly good, like you're just right in it. So I want to talk about that. But before we talk about that, there's a couple things I want to hit, because I know once we start talking about Jersey, we're not going to come back. We're not going to come back from that. So I want to talk about some of your other work quickly. So you have a new book out, which has nothing to do with any of this. It is a biography of Arianna Huffington called Arianna Huffington, Media Visionary and Wellness Evangelist, which is a biography of the founder of HuffPo. So what inspired you to write about her?
I have been wanting to do biographies for a while now. So when a publisher came to me from Hachette and asked if I would do a business biography, there was actually a little list of people to choose from, but there were almost no women on the list. And I honestly write so much about men, and quite frankly, because Wall Street and finance is just very male dominated, as is journalism, you don't often see anyone who's successful on Wall Street or in media that's a woman, and Arianna is both. So I thought, I'll try Arianna Huffington. She's had such an almost sugary sweet exterior and image. I thought there's gotta be a lot going on underneath all of it, because no one is sugary sweet exterior. You know, that's obviously a very manicured image, if that's almost anyone. So I was very curious about her life and found out that she was a Republican and a Democrat and then a Republican again, and then a Democrat again. And that happened like many times in her career. She was highly conservative when she first grew up in Athens, Greece. And then she moved to London, England. And she like totally established herself in England in a really big way. Nationally, she was known before she moved to the United States. And everywhere she went, she became this fixture on the map. But it wasn't until she was 54 years old and she founded the Huffington Post that she became nationally known across the United States. And then of course, internationally known when she started opening bureaus in cities across the world. So that was when, you know, it's hard to write a biography about anybody when the thing that made them the most famous started when they were 54, right? You have to cover that first half century.
Yeah.
What on earth were they doing back then? You know, and so it was quite an adventure to kind of put the book together and to talk about her past. Much of her past is sort of as she told it. And then you start looking through and you realize it's actually different than what she says it was. And you have to go into all those little pieces and start, you know, interviewing people, figuring out what is what. So I really enjoyed it. I also enjoyed her, just her amazing mastery of curating facts and curating her own life and how she would influence opinion, public opinion, whether she was living overseas or whether she was living here. She got very involved in how do you effectively manipulate public opinion. And a lot of that in the book about how you manicure your own image, it comes across just because that was something she was really focused on from a very young age, how to impress people the way she wanted to by observing and also emulating.
Curating facts is a really good term. I just wrote that down. I'm gonna save that for later. Yeah.
She really wasn't a journalist, even though she would call herself a journalist. She actually was someone who was just attained an incredible mastery of how to convey a specific image depending on what her goals were. for whatever it was she was doing. And throughout the book, it talks about all of her different incarnations from, she was tried to be governor of California, which we all forget about.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah.
She ran for governor and she in fact had a debate with Arnold Schwarzenegger before he took office. And that was just wild. You know, I believe because they both had really strong accents. Remember Arnold Schwarzenegger, he'd just come off of like his huge Terminator sort of tour de force. And then Arianna Huffington wasn't as well known because she hadn't even launched a Huffington Post yet, but she was still like always trying to get out in the open and always be in the center. And during the filing to become a candidate, she appeared at the courthouse the same time as Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the press was interviewing him, and she knocked over an entire bank of microphones trying to like get in the picture, you know, get into the cameras. And later on when they interviewed her and said, yes, so you knocked over all those mics, remember that? And she said, I think it went very good. I think it went very well. And that was it. Yeah, and she's just like so unflappable. So I was amazed by her story of no matter what, forging forward and really kind of almost always making sure she had her way with every situation. And if she didn't get her way, she'd just move on. She actually would pretend like it never happened. Just move on to the next thing.
Yeah, microphones never fail. I don't know what you're talking about. her, you know, like Starbucks, the genius of Starbucks was to take a cup of coffee that cost 50 cents and charge $4.50 for it.
Yeah.
So the genius of the Huffington Post is to take journalists that you have to pay and just not pay them. Just be like, hey, create content for the site and you'll have your name on the byline on the Huffington Post. It'll be great. And, it worked out really well for her. So I have bylines. I have a page in the Huffington Post. I wrote a couple of pieces there years ago. Hasn't everyone? It's like a New York, all New York actors appear on Law and Order at some point. It's like, you know, rite of passage for writers. I don't know. Am I remembering that right? Did she invent that model or appropriate it? Or am I impugning her for something she didn't do?
No, you're not. She loved putting her own articles on her website after she ran for office and lost in California. What she learned was, oh, the internet. That was basically what she got out of that campaign, was the internet, and actually let's use it. And she was using it in her campaign. So it really came from this model of her posting her own articles on her own website and then wanting to also encourage others to do the same. And she loved the interaction with like people leaving comments, and she would write back. And she loved that whole, let me influence public discourse, you know, let me encourage people to comment and have, you know, dialogue. So she thought, well, what if I can do all that with all my celebrity friends? And then let's just not only include celebrities, let's let anyone who wants to do it, do it. And it was kind of a very organically developed model. I think Arianna never wanted to pay for anything. I mean, Arianna, I think it's probably true that everything she did, she would try to get someone else to cover, you know, the launch or the bill or the expenses, or in that inclusive the Huffington Post, she did a lot of fundraising, but really she was very savvy. She would always try to make sure other people were investing, and then she would work very hard from there. And so when it launched, she just brought all these other people in, and then she started giving her card to anyone. She would meet women in a ladies' room. Hey, write for our blog, you know? And so she built up this platform, which I don't know if it initially intended to be exploitative, but as we know, that's what happened, right?
Yeah.
It became this very powerful platform where you could post, but you weren't gonna get paid. And if you were a wealthy celebrity, well, who cares, right? You know, you're fine with that. You don't need to be paid. But journalists were posting and not being paid. That was probably not the best use of the platform, but a lot of them felt like, well, everybody's reading me because the platform gets all this traffic. And I think Arianna's attitude was, we're paying for all this so you can have a platform. And, you know, and journalists were saying, yeah, but you know, I could be writing somewhere else. And to which she would say, well, then go do that. You know, like if you're gonna post here, there's no pay. But as you know, now the Huffington Post does pay and decided to do away with that because it was causing so much trouble. But there were lawsuits. There was a lot of fighting over that. And I think if you're going to launch a journalistic organization, you probably should be paying your writers I think we all know that.
Probably. Yeah, that's probably
and,
a good.
And, but Ariana didn't like to pay for anything. I mean, that was just fundamental to her. She did not want to pay for things.
Well, growing up, you know, she grew up in Greece after the war, and there, Greece had some major weird history with financial stuff. Like in the 1920s, especially the country was in such massive debt and had a such a problem with paying down its debts that the finance minister, whose name escapes me, came up with the bright idea of taking the largest denomination banknotes and ripping them in half, and the government would get the right half.
Oh.
And the person would get the left half, and they would get the money back eventually. So this was a way of sort of, it would be like if we just came to your house and ripped up a $100 bill, and we took the right half or whatever part Benjamin Franklin was on. And later, when we say it's okay, you can come back and we'll give you the other half, and then you can go spend it. So this actually kind of worked. It was this weird, twisted way. But the guy that came up with this idea was executed by firing squad for treason 2 years after coming up with this idea. So anyway, yeah, Greece is a weird post-war, pre-war, that whole Greece stuff is, there's a lot of weird stuff going on. So it's interesting that,
yes,
you know, she doesn't want to pay for stuff, I think is, comes out of her growing up maybe in that environment.
Well, you know, I will say Wall Street, they also, you know, it's like anything else, is try and get people to invest in what you want to do, but try and not put your own money in. And so she could have also gotten some advice along those lines. That's a typical financier type approach for a lot of people, both on Wall Street and Silicon Valley. So I don't want to give her credit for that idea, but it is a popular concept of don't put your own skin in the game, make it someone else's skin.
Yeah, it's cowardly, man. Okay, now speaking of things with zero and negative value.
Yes, okay, please. So I'll just say, get the book. It's great. It's, you know, it was a very fun ride. It was. I will just say this: if you ever read Vanity Fair by Thackeray, it was. She's like a real life Becky Sharp. Hustling her way through all 800 pages. It's,
yeah.
Every time you think, oh, it can't get more dramatic or wild, it does. So that was fun.
Yeah, no, I was looking at it today on Amazon. I was like, I'll read the beginning of this to prepare, having really no interest in Ariana Huffington. And I was totally swept into it right away. So yes, go get the book. Okay, so you've written about a lot of stuff that I think is kind of fascinating. So another thing that I wanted to talk about is oil. Now, you wrote a book about the oil industry and some of the shenanigans. And lately, you wrote a bunch of pieces about this fuckery that happened last April where the price of oil was like negative somehow. And, you know, I'm not an economist. I don't know anything about finance, but it seems to me that a barrel of oil should have a value of greater than zero. So what the fuck, man, what happened?
Yeah. I love writing about anything where deceit is a part of the story. Or sleight of hand, maybe I should say, is a part of the story, and any topic like that I love. So with oil, the fundamental of oil was that the market went off the rails, right? I mean, oil was never being exchanged at below zero. That actually never, nobody sold a barrel of real oil for zero or less than zero. It literally never happened. So it tells you a lot about what our markets can do, right? While in real life, something else is happening. And that was what happened with our oil market. We had a bunch of traders trading oil futures, which is a contract to buy or sell oil. And that contract's price went off the rails. But in real life, right, back in real life, where there's real physical markets for oil, not paper markets, which is what futures are. In the physical markets, that day, all the traders just kind of sat out. They did not trade oil at below zero. I talked to them myself. I remember one guy said to me, he said, yeah, whenever the paper traders lose their minds, we just chill out that day. We don't trade. So, you know, if you're thinking of it as parallel tracks, you have one track that's on track and one track that's like, but when we report on oil prices, right? When we read about oil prices in the news, it's actually reflecting the paper market. And the reason why is because it's a very liquid, we call it a liquid market, where there's lots of activity. And so because there's so much activity and so much trading, it is seen as the most lively, active, and best to see a moving price, right? Because there's so many people involved in it. So you can watch that price mm-hmm. move very easily. You can buy and sell in it very easily, usually right. not on that day. And so back when this happened in 2020, when prices tanked and then went beyond zero to below zero, you know, the market was still liquid, but a lot of people in the real world of physical barrels, what we call wet barrels,
okay,
they were not participating that day because who wants to sell a barrel of oil for zero? Nobody. And so they weren't. And the whole reason it happened was, as you know, the pandemic was sweeping over us. It was last April, right? Last year. So we're all starting to get hammered in early, I would say, right? By around March 12th, things started to really go off. Yep. And then by April, we knew we were in trouble. New York at that time was the epicenter of the pandemic globally.
Yes.
And New York is really the center of the tradable oil market. It's the New York Mercantile Exchange is where oil prices originate in this country. And the it's called NYMEX for short, New York Mercantile Exchange. But NYMEX is followed globally as well as the benchmark for oil prices. The number one thing you watch when you're wondering what is oil trading at in the United States. And so we were getting hit, demand dropped, right? No one was driving, no one was commuting. Everybody was hunkering down and sheltering in place. And with demand dropping, storage levels of oil went up, and of all fossil fuel products that are energy related, they started to fill up. And so tradable oil has a storage place, and that storage place is in Cushing, Oklahoma, and Cushing was becoming full. The storage was getting really high.
Okay.
And traders started to panic because they thought if Cushing becomes so full that it can no longer take barrels, then we have nowhere to put our barrels if we end up taking delivery of oil. So we better not have any oil right now because we'll have nowhere to put it. And so people started getting rid of their oil barrels as fast as they could. And that was when prices started to go down. But we also saw prices go down sometimes more than $25 every minute or two that day,
oh, wow.
Right? Which is not normal. Yeah. In fact, later on, a market manipulation expert said that is a 4D standard deviation event, which means it would not happen in the life of the universe for natural reasons. So that is why people believe there was a lot of manipulation that day. And there were a lot of traders bragging that day about how much money they made, or there were traders seen to be crushing the market by selling very heavily as it approached zero. There were a lot of traders who were accused of various things that day. And we also know that the trading platforms that people were using, some of them froze. So there were traders that actually
oh, wow.
couldn't trade because their platform froze on them. And so there's still lawsuits playing out because of all this, and still a lot of finger pointing. And there's not a clear picture still of who was to blame.
I'm going to blame Russia. I'm going to go ahead and blame Russia because I didn't know that about the websites freezing. That's it. Russia has one thing that they do, and that's oil. Everything else, it's they export disinformation, botnets, and depressing novels and oil. So I just blame them. I know we have no proof. We have no proof here, but I'm going to go out on a limb. Now, it's interesting. You talked about the storage problem. The analogy that I would make is I have not enough room in my cabinets for all of the glassware that I own. So some of it is either in the dishwasher or in use. But if everyone else is gone and it's just me and I run two loads in a row, I don't have anywhere to put various glasses. So it's the same kind of thing, but with oil. So, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, everyone was worried oil, they call it topping out, right? What if oil tops out in Cushing, which is this lonely little town way out in Oklahoma. It's just filled with oil tanks. And if you are going to deliver a barrel of oil, you're supposed to deliver it into Cushing. And if somebody's taking that barrel and they have nowhere to put it, well, that's a whole lot of oil, right? A whole lot of one contract of oil is 1,000 barrels of oil. So if you just buy one contract, where are you going to put 1,000 barrels of oil? And so people started to liquidate rapidly and there was an overreaction. I have one great detail for you.
Okay.
That day, one of my oil sources called me and said, I got a call from the White House today when oil tanked. And the Trump White House, of course.
Right, of course. Yeah.
He said, I said, who said it? Who called you? And he said, I don't want to say who. He did tell me who, but I won't okay. give him away. He said it was one of Trump's market advisors, who's not really a market advisor, but kind of a pseudo market advisor. And he called this oil trader friend of mine and said, what's happening with oil? And he said, what do you want to know? You know, it just went below zero. And he said, Trump's confused and needs assistance with understanding the energy market. And so that day, I don't know if you saw, but at the end of the day, Trump said, during his press conference, he said, I really like the zero oil and I'm happy to take free oil if anyone wants it for the strategic petroleum reserve in the United States. I'll take it. He said, but I really like the barrel that they pay you to take, meaning if it's at a negative price.
So he did figure it out. Good for him.
He did. I don't think he realized that wasn't actually ever happening, but
yeah,
he was trying to keep up that day.
Give him credit. That's as much math as he's done in quite some time. And you know, he's trying to make a buck. That's his MO. Now, it's nice being an investigative journalist as you are. You get to go to these glamorous places like Cushing, Oklahoma.
Very glamorous.
Yeah. I can't even imagine somewhere more glamorous where the wind is sweeping through the plains. But Jersey is a different sort of story. I think Jersey is kind of glamorous. You've been there many times over the years. Yeah. What's it like? How big is it? Where is it? Hip us to the Jersey thing.
Oh, Jersey is an island off the coast of France. It's about 12 miles off the coast of France, and it's a very small island. It's 5 by 9 miles. I once said it was long time ago, said it was 4 by 9 miles instead of 5 by 9 miles. And Jersey never let me forget it. Every time I wrote a story about Jersey, there'd be 5 or 10 people from Jersey saying, she got 1 mile wrong on our mileage. And so you've got to be really careful when you report on Jersey, but it's 45 square miles.
Okay.
And it's about 100,000 people. And I never knew anything about Jersey. Of course, we heard of New Jersey.
We have. But we are from there. Yeah.
Yeah. I lived in New Jersey briefly after journalism school. And
then you did the sensible thing and left. Yes.
I still live in New Jersey. But, you know, I don't remember in geography class learning anything about Jersey. And you would think we would have at least heard about it because we have a state named for it, but nothing. And Jersey has done a very good job through the years of being very below the radar. They're almost invisible to the world, even though they are a $2 trillion tax shelter. And they take a lot of pains to keep it that way. They don't want to be known in the world. They really just want to be a place for people to do business very, very discreetly, very privately, and really otherwise should be under the radar and to be sub rosa. So I didn't know that, you know, years and years ago, New Jersey was actually the part of New Jersey that was named for Jersey was the New Netherlands. Did not know that, but then the de Carteret family in Jersey fell into the king's favor centuries ago and was gifted pieces of New Jersey, mostly northern New Jersey. And as a result, that's why it's called New Jersey. And the de Carteret family is still a family on the island of Jersey. And it's still a very Frenchified island, really, with a lot of the names are French sounding. You mentioned Stuart Sivray, the former health minister who you interviewed. Sivray is another very ancient French Norman type name that you would typically hear in Jersey and maybe nowhere else. It has the island has an ancient culture and heritage that they're very, very proud of and is completely unique in the world. It's like its own country. The island has its own parliament, its own currency, its own telecom company, meaning that means your telephone lines, that means your internet lines, and its own postal service. Everything is just totally in-house. And the legal system is in-house. It has its own Jersey Royal Court. And so anything that happens in Jersey is infinitely controlled by Jersey.
Well, with one glaring exception, which is the monarch is not in-house.
Yes, although the monarch and Jersey have a very special relationship. So the Queen of England, she is the person who really appoints the key power players on the island. And those are the head of the court, the head of parliament, basically the head of the legal system, the attorney general. And there's a lieutenant governor that basically is an on-site representative to the queen on the island, also appointed by her. And they hold the power. They hold the main power and the Solicitor General. So they don't get voted for. There are elected officials, but frequently it is those key power players appointed by the queen that are in control. And so because those crown officers are really running things, and I might add, there is no separation of powers the way we understand in a democracy. The head of parliament is also the head of the courts and the appeals court. So you have a making law body and a carrying out law body that are inextricably linked in ways that cause lots of issues on the island. Many, many miscarriages of justice take place on the island because of those deficits in the democracy. And only when you like can study it in real life can you start to see how problematic it is. It's again why so many things can be infinitely controlled on the island when it comes to its business, when they're creating shelter situations for those in finance. And it's the reason why it's such a successful tax shelter.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the conflicts of interest that are inherent in that system, I should say, are vast. And it's almost like it's a feature, not a bug kind of thing, would be my guess. No, wait, so who is the bailiff? The bailiff, I thought, was the guy in charge. Is that the technical name or is that?
I would say the bailiff tends to be the single most powerful person on the island.
Okay.
And again, there is a chief minister, but the bailiff heads parliament and the bailiff also oversees the courts.
Okay, so that is the guy that oversees it. Because it's called the Bailiwick of Jersey, which I think is cool.
Bailiwick. It's a very, I mean, a lot of these things are, they have a long-standing history. And there is a feeling on the island when you visit and you ask questions of, this is how we do things. And it shall not be questioned, right? Even the journalists on the island feel frequently when I talk to them that they can't report things that are happening, which is part of the problem as well, mm-hmm. because no one else ever does it. So, well, it just doesn't happen. It's just not done. And so then they don't. And so there's this prevailing silence that also happens over incidents and situations like child abuse, which we'll be talking about. The island has a pretty serious issue with child abuse, child endangerment, and what I would call VIP pedophiles. Some of them very powerful, some of them very wealthy, some of them very aligned or hooked in various ways to finance on the island and in other ways to the monarchy. So you have, or politics. So you have these leaders on the island who also, some of them have been accused of some pretty horrific things without any real justice, right? What would it be like if you lived on a small island where major accusations with multiple witnesses led to literally nothing? And you continue to see those people circulating and not being taken to court, not being held to account. And everyone just pretended that it was fine. Those sorts of things do happen in Jersey. And the financial side, the tax haven side, is also very problematic because it's such a small island and there's so much money at stake that the reputation and image of the island ends up coming first a lot of the time, even when there are major issues going on of justice. It will be that the crown officers will really come together and make sure that the image of the island comes first. And the queen herself seems to protect those crown officers in doing what they want to do when it comes to protecting the image of the island. She appears to endorse this because she repeatedly knights them. Mm. Even those who are involved in overlooking child abuse, she will knight them. And so it really does not make the queen look like she cares about what's happening to some of those islanders when they are hurt or they are vulnerable.
We're going to take a quick break. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about Haute Le Guerin. We'll be right back. Leah McGrath Goodman.
I'm former FBI Assistant Director Frank Figluzzi. Join me on a journey deep inside the world's premier law enforcement agency to decode the mysteries and challenges of today's FBI. The threats facing America are as real as the men and women who battle to protect us. In this first-of-a-kind podcast, we'll sit down with active duty FBI personnel who reveal their mission, their cases, and their lives. Let's go inside The Bureau with Frank Figlusi.
Homicides, sexual assaults, missing persons, and unidentified human remains.
Somehow a computer could solve crimes.
93 homicides.
I am one of those guys that I have wanted to be an FBI in since I was 6 years old.
M.O., his modus operandi.
Busting down doors with guns drawn.
But I would be lying to you if I said I wasn't much more aware of the guy sitting in a vehicle on the roadside when I'm walking my dog at night.
Unsolved cases sitting in evidence rooms on shelves.
They didn't want to have sex with them. They just wanted to kill someone.
Okay, we're back with Leah McGrath Goodman. You mentioned the scandals on Jersey and being amazed that it happens. It reminds me, and I know you're going to talk about it in a minute, what actually happened, but there was a princess named Elisabetha Báthory from Hungary in medieval times who was a serial killer and used to go out and have her people prowl the countryside for young girls who she would kill to bathe in their blood. This is true. You can Google this. And because she was a royal and a noble and a psychopath, everyone just let it go. And we think now, hey, it's 2021. Something that awful wouldn't happen in today's world, certainly not in a civilized country. And yet I know what's happening in Jersey isn't quite as bad as that, but it's closer to that than to the way things should be. So why don't you talk a little bit about the scandal and how you got involved with reporting on the story?
Yeah, so I was finishing a book on the oil market. It was an oral history of the traders who built the global oil market called The Asylum, which was my first book. And I was finishing writing it. And I had already traveled to Jersey many times when I lived in England. I had friends on the island. Most of them were hedge funders, bank people, people in finance. It's very dominated by finance. It really is an island where you walk down the main street and there's banks everywhere, really. It is somewhat overwhelming, all the brand names around you. And I was finishing this book and there was this terrible scandal surrounding a children's home called Hot de la Garenne, which is this stoned Victorian building up on a hill overlooking the ocean on the island of Jersey. And the police were doing a dig under the home because there were reports of horrific violence there over the course of decades. And two relatively new police officers who were not from Jersey, who had come from England and Scotland, the two top cops had decided, we're gonna look into the child abuse on the island. You know, we've been hearing so many reports and it seems like a lot of it comes to nothing. Let's once and for all find out what's going on. And so they took these reports from many different people and decided to do a dig. As they were digging under the home, that's when the headlines started. And some of them were quite dramatic. And you will see in the film, the BBC film that you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, it talks a lot about the wild headlines, you know, children's bodies found, another five bodies found, you know, that sort of thing. What they were finding were small human remains. There was not bodies. There wasn't that much left, to be honest. They found small human remains, fragments of bone, and also lots of teeth. And they were finding them in concerning parts of the children's home, including where the old furnace used to be. And they brought in a cadaver dog that went wild in various parts of the home, which was a positive for the smell of cadaver, right? However, because so much had been destroyed, so much evidence had been destroyed, they didn't know which children were linked with which bones. And there was such a long period, several decades, where these reports tracked all the way back to right around the time the Nazis occupied the island during World War II.
Right.
That they weren't sure what was what. They didn't have a report of a homicide, for example. And so there were a lot of issues as the scandal was being reported out. What happened to these children? You know, why were there human remains? How old are they? They started to date some of the human remains. They never finished dating everything. We still don't know the age of the teeth. It seems that at least with the analysis that they did do, that the teeth went from very young children to, I think, as old as 12. But there were a bunch of those teeth of multiple children found in places like the furnace. And, you know, and it was obviously very upsetting, but the islanders as well had different stories they'd heard or had friends they knew who had been at the home. And then there were all these high level people who were being accused of abuse at the home. And so it was sort of like this horrible explosive moment where things that had been kept hidden for many years came to the surface. And that was when I started looking at it. But what caught my attention was the police in charge of the dig began to be attacked. It looked as though politicians on the island and some of the crown officers and others were trying to bury them under the idea of, well, they're spending too much on the dig. Or in another case, the local newspaper tried to, you know, smear one of the top cops investigating. And it just got worse and worse to the point where you got the feeling, watching me, an American journalist, why is it that the police are being attacked? It doesn't seem like the island cares about the child abuse. It seems like they're more upset that it's being investigated. And I started to see even the remains were being questioned. They said that they had found a piece of skull fragment. Suddenly they said it was a coconut shell. You know, nobody could explain how a skull fragment had turned into a coconut shell. It started to get really absurd, right? And that was when, as a journalist, I became a lot more interested in Haut de la Garenne. What is really going on? Because as I was watching those events unfold, I noticed increasingly it looked like those who wanted to cover up what had happened were winning. And yeah. People were being driven off the island. And as you know, Stuart Sivray, the health minister who stood up and said, I can no longer guarantee the safety of children on this island. He was driven out of his job. And so anyone who stuck up for children suddenly were all being driven out of their jobs. The police officers, one of them retired, but was threatened repeatedly until he retired. The other one was repeatedly suspended. They're also in the film talking about their experiences, so I'll let them speak for themselves. But the film catalogs what happened and what made it so troubling. And to be really honest, the film only scratches the tip of the iceberg. There's no way to put into a feature film everything that happened. And that's why I'm writing a book on what happened at Haut de la Garenne. Because I think it's truly extraordinary that in a Western democracy, you could have hundreds of victims coming forward and children's remains. And then in the end, it's as though it never happened.
Yeah.
No, which is really what the island has, you know, the press on the island and officials on the island have tried to pretend as though what happened did not happen.
They've curated the facts is what they've done.
Yes.
I'm making light of something that we shouldn't make light of, but I want to, two points that I want to ask about. The orphanage on the island, as I understand it, it wasn't just orphans from Jersey that are on the island. It's orphans from all over. Do I have that right?
Yeah, one of the saddest things was the home was really a place for a lot of the children. There were immigrant children or children of immigrants on the island. So there was, again, this feeling of a certain group of people were being picked on, right? A certain specific group of people who weren't necessarily local to the island or originally local to the island were being targeted maybe more than they should have been. And there was certainly like a preying on going on with that particular children's home. It's also in a very affluent neighborhood, which is also kind of noticeable. And when I first visited the island, walking up the hill to the children's home, there was a very large mansion that I passed by right before I got there. And there's a huge stone gate. It's actually on my Twitter feed. It's the cover photo.
Oh, okay.
A huge stone gate with a very vulnerable looking naked boy statue on the top. And it's not a normal statue. It's not like a cherub. It's a vulnerable looking naked boy who's very thin and very pale. And he's just sitting there. And I asked one of the politicians on the island later, what is going on with that creepy gate? And they said, oh yeah, he's just an eccentric, but he loves little boys. And one of the female politicians who represented that area, she said, you should see his door knocker when you go up to the house, because it's a long, long road. You can't see the house. And I said, what's that? And she said, a boy on a swing, and I won't tell you what's knocking the door. Boy on a swing.
This is something this is a guy that lives right near the,
right next to the house. Yeah. And there was other statuary that was noted by a few other people, including a filmmaker who did another film called Sun, Sea, and Satan. He did a film where he talked about the unusual statuary in the area that seemed to celebrate very young naked children. So the thing that was so disturbing is that kind of combination of openly displaying things like that.
Right.
While also, whenever child abuse came up, everybody going silent, right? Like the paper tries to not say anything, or they smear the people investigating it. People are getting thrown out of the legislature who want to talk about it, like Stuart Seabrook. You know, it was very much of an ecosystem that was not dealing with this problem and was very much trying to make it go away. And to this day, as I told you before this conversation today, this is still happening even after the film, even after multiple stories about too much child abuse that's not getting tackled in the justice system on the island. And the Queen continuing to knight people on the island who are seen as part of the cover-up.
It's just awful. And what it reminds me of, I mean, it's worse, really. But what it reminds me of is the Epstein stuff. I mean, this was a guy who basically did what he did, was pretty open about it to everybody he came across. Everybody sort of knew what he was up to. And they just kind of let him do it for years and years and years. And it was just sort of okay. The through line in Epstein in this place is Andrew, who I think was he the finance minister in Jersey for a while, or am I getting the facts wrong with that?
So I won't say that Prince Andrew's, I don't know if Prince Andrew had very much of a relationship directly with Jersey, as we know he did with Epstein. I will say that while I reported out my last story on Jersey, which is called The Heiress, the Queen, and the $1 trillion Tax Shelter, and that is in Institutional Investor magazine. When I was reporting it out, and I was talking about money laundering, corruption, and child abuse, which do overlap with each other on the island of Jersey, I was reached out to by a spokesperson for one of the individuals in my story, who not only was involved with the money laundering aspect of things, but was clearly, when I Googled him and looked more closely into him, he was involved with Prince Andrew. And I mean directly involved with Prince Andrew. And so again, you live in England, or if you go to Jersey, it's a small world. It really is. If you mail a letter in England, it arrives sometimes by the very next day, wherever you're sending it. You know, it's not like in the US where you mail something from Boston and then you're like a week later, did they get it?
Right.
Did they get it yet? Like, it's a very small kingdom when you look at it. And the powerful people there have it locked up pretty good. And I would have never considered the Queen as a potential villain in a story like this. I would have laughed you out the door if years ago you said, take a look at the Queen, it's not pretty. I would have laughed and said, that's a little melodramatic. But I don't think that anymore, because I've seen her knight too many people who clearly were part of the problem. And she also seems to look the other way when it comes to family members, improprieties, whether it's Prince Andrew or whether it's financial improprieties that we saw with Prince Michael, right? Mm-hmm. We just saw that. And so it just seems that if you're a royal or if you have money, that you can do whatever you want, more or less. And that seems to be a problem that is still being dealt with in England as well as Jersey.
I think it is hard to wrap your mind around the Queen being at the epicenter of this. Even Stuart Seabrey had problem. He refused to say flat out, oh yeah, you know, I think even he was holding out hope that she personally wasn't necessarily to blame. Although clearly she's been, if she's not. Read into what's happening there, it's willfully not knowing, I think, at this point. And I find it very hard to believe that Andrew doesn't know what's going on, given his relationship to Epstein and giving Epstein's relationship to Robert Maxwell and the Queen's relationship to Robert Max. Just this, all of this nexus of stuff, it's just a little too on the nose.
It starts to feel a little cozy if you're a journalist researching it, like me or like you. you start to look at this person, then you look at that person, you start looking at their external networks, right? But you don't have to go very far, right? You just look at some of their associates, and you realize everyone's associates are overlapping. And if you do the timeline, you start to realize, well, he must have heard about that by then, right? It was in the national press that that guy knew about that guy. And then you start looking at it and you think these people all know about each other and they're still doing this stuff with each other, whether it's financial or unfortunately related to child abuse. And so you're right though, Epstein proves that this was a global network, right? We can't say Epstein was uniquely English. He wasn't, he was American.
Oh yeah.
I mean, we can't just say, oh, America's different. Like, America's clearly not different. It looks unfortunately like there's a large global network of very privileged people who seem to be involved in some of this stuff. And I just didn't realize how pivotal Jersey was to the story because it's such a tiny island.
And people who do make the realization that it's pivotal meet with some resistance, I should say. I know Stuart has been in prison a couple times, three times, I believe. The poor guy can't get a lawyer to represent him anywhere, not in Jersey, not in London, like nowhere. And you've had issues yourself with the authorities in the UK and in Jersey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you in the Hooskow?
Was I in the what?
The Hooskow jail. Did they lock you up? What did they do?
No, but I think we need to point out, since we're on this track, is Stuart has been repeatedly imprisoned. He was not only the health minister for the island of Jersey and one of the most senior politicians, he almost became its chief minister, the island's chief minister, which is like the president of the island. And he was the father of the house, meaning, you know, he would give the Christmas speech every year, or he would, you know, he was considered most senior. And so for someone who was that level that Stuart was at, getting kicked out because he's trying to defend those who are vulnerable and those who are victims of child abuse, trying to stick up for them. He gets kicked out for that, right? Not only that, he was suspended many times for objecting to financial improprieties on the island, and he was in prison. So you have that. And then you have child abusers who are known on the island, who don't get suspended, continue to have their jobs, continue to be in many cases exposed to children on a regular basis in their jobs, and still hold positions of power, including in parliament, who don't go to jail and don't get kicked out of their jobs. So basically, yes, you can be that and not lose your job, but no, you can't stick up for children and not lose your job. So the facts speak for themselves. In my case, when I started investigating, it was 2011 that I was crossing the border doing more interviews. I'd already started interviews on the island. I'd been mostly visiting friends and then meeting with different people involved in the Hot De La Guerra situation, meeting with survivors of child abuse who felt like no one was listening to them, and meeting with officials who were involved in the dig under the home and getting evidence and talking to any number of politicians as well. I was crossing the border and they locked me up at Heathrow Airport and interrogated me. And the way it works, how do they lock you up, right? How do they do that? You know, you're walking through the airport. I went up to give them my passport at the passport check, and they said, could you step to the side? We have a few questions. And I said, yeah, of course. You know, so I waited. They led me to the baggage carousel and got my luggage, which seemed strange. And then we went to a room in the back, and then they took me to like a basement room and they left with my luggage. And at that point I was obviously very uncomfortable. And they said, well, we're just going to put your luggage in this room while we talk to you. That was not what was happening. They were going through my luggage.
Right. Yeah.
Obviously. Then they brought me to a room and locked the door behind me, at which point I said, what on earth is going on? And they said, oh, it's okay. It's just procedure.
Okay.
Yeah. They like procedure. They fingerprinted me. They photographed me. Again, no questions were being asked. At this point, now my luggage is confiscated. I am locked up and my personal details are being documented. Still have no answers to any questions or being asked any questions. So I sit in a room for maybe 5 hours. There's a windowless room with a latrine off the side and wouldn't talk to me, wouldn't tell me anything. I asked to call my lawyer. Nope. My embassy. Nope. I said, well, I mean, I obviously have rights. And they said, nope, you're not in England. You're not anywhere. This is the border. You've not been admitted. It's a black site.
Oh God.
Nobody knows this, but Heathrow, Gatwick, and the Eurotunnel are black sites. And so if you're caught in the middle, right? If you're caught in that in between, it is not considered any territory and therefore you don't have any human rights. They have stricter rules now than they did then, but I was kept there for over 12 hours, which was past the legal limit. And they eventually interrogated me. They wanted to know where I was staying on the island, who I was talking to. And I was very uncooperative, as you can imagine. I didn't mind telling them, you know, what I was working on, but I wasn't going to talk about who I was interviewing or where I was living or any of that. So they deported me and I got a letter saying, do not come back for 2 years, that I was banned for 2 years. Wow. And so, yeah. And so then
From Jersey, or from the UK?
The entire UK and Jersey.
Okay.
All of it. But I then started obviously like appealing. And so it was a legal fight. Members of parliament got involved. A member of parliament in Jersey actually put up a change.org petition demanding that my visa be restored. Another parliament member in England also made a lot of noise. There were multiple articles written. The Guardian did a story, the BBC did a story. So eventually what I learned was if you embarrass the establishment into submission, then they will give you your visa back. But before that, they weren't going to do anything based on the rules or decency or anything. They were just hoping I would go away.
That's really, you must've been terrified. I would have been terrified. That's really like a fucking nightmare. I mean, like a literal nightmare that one would have while sleeping. Right. I mean,
if you go to my website, there's surveillance footage. If you go through the top photos, there's surveillance footage that shows me in the room. It's black and white. Yeah.
I'm glad you said the detail about the latrine, because the first thing that I think of whenever anybody is detained is, oh my God, I have to pee right now. Where are you going to go do? So at least, you know, the detail was provided. Certainly in my nightmare, that's always what I'm worried about.
Your nightmare is where's the bathroom?
Always. I'm always in a New York that isn't New York trying to find a place to go to the bathroom. Literally.
Oh my everywhere. God. The best part was when I, so you can file something called a subject access request. So you can see your file and you're entitled to it. It took us years to get my file. Years and years. Mm. Finally got it. And it's an argument between the UK and the island, where basically the UK authorities are like, what do you want us to do with her? You know, and like Jersey's like, you know, hold on, it's a Sunday, we'll get back to you. Like they were like, they were kind of caught flat-footed. They had apparently flagged me, saying if she comes over the border on her way to Jersey, stop her. But then no one understood what was going on. And it was sort of like one hand was not washing the other. And so even the people interrogating me had no idea what was going on and looked confused during the interrogation. So, I mean, it was just kind of a mess. It was sort of the way you would imagine it, you know, when you look at Brexit and you say, what might have also happened when Leah was being interrogated? It was sort of like Brexit. A bunch of confused people following orders, really having no idea what they were doing. And so I wasn't angry with the officers. I just was mostly, a couple of times I was like, you know, this is because I'm investigating child abuse, right? And they looked really upset by that. Nobody wanted to be involved in this, right? Nobody wanted to have their fingerprints on it.
Yeah. Yeah. God, yeah. It's really terrifying. Okay. So we have a little time. We're not on TV here. We can go a few minutes longer. So, because I want to talk just briefly, you wrote the article that you mentioned, which is called, where the heck
did I write that? The Heiress, the Queen, and the Trillion Dollar Tax Shelter.
As soon as I looked, my eyes found it on the page. You read it. Yeah. Which is a terrific piece. And it was the first thing. It's not actually the first thing of yours that I had read. It's the first thing of yours that I was aware that was yours that I had read. And I was like, this is amazing, because it's about basically not the child abuse stuff. It's about the money laundering and the financial shenanigans. So tell us a little bit. I mean, I really encourage people to go read this article, because it's kind of a mind blow. But tell us a little bit about what you found out there.
Yeah, maybe we can link to it. We can make sure.
I'll link to all the stuff. Don't worry. Yeah.
Excellent. So I got a phone call from somebody who runs a tax shelter related monitoring organization. And he said, did you hear about what happened in Jersey with this gigantic trove of documents that were found on a squash court on a fancy 58-acre manor in Jersey? And I said, no, tell me more. And so this past fall, a couple named Tanya and Darren Stock, they reported finding this gigantic trove and brought it to journalists, including me, talking about a whole bunch of money laundering that had been going on the island for years and years. And they didn't even know it was happening at the manor. It's this beautiful manor house. And it was actually the headquarters of a company that was doing the money laundering. And so they found these documents and tried to get the Jersey authorities to do something, right? So they called the police. Looks like this is a money laundering operation. Tanya Stock, whose maiden name is Tanya Dick. So she goes by Tanya Dick Stock, which is a mouthful. She was getting married and they were just trying to find extra space for the caterer on this beautiful manor. She grew up, you know, she did grow up in this beautiful home. She is American. She was born in Colorado, but she was on the island of Jersey. They were clearing the squash court for the caterer, and that's when they found all of these bank boxes. There were hundreds and hundreds of documents with all these different people who had been trying to conceal their money or shelter their money on the island or through trust companies. And it was all being done through this manor. She and her husband, once they were married, called the police, reported it to the Jersey police. The police came and took all the boxes, giant truck, and then nothing happened. They just took the documents and they called and kept on it. And it turned out that the police ultimately gave the documents to a law firm that now has them in a safe, never to be seen again.
Yeah.
But they were able to scan the documents before they lost them to the police and now to this law firm. And those are the documents that they have leaked to the world. So I was going through these documents and finding the names of the companies, the names of the people who were in them. They're actually still going through these documents. They managed to scan many of them. Nobody's read all of them yet. It's 350,000 pages. So it's this ongoing process to get through all the documents and to find out what's in them. But the story I wrote for Institutional Investor is what we know so far. And their story, the story of this couple trying to bring the documents to a place that will do something about the money laundering. They found that Jersey did not want to do anything. So my article talks—
No way, get right out of town. I'm so surprised.
My article talks to each group in Jersey, the financial authority, the local courts, the royal court, the lawyers involved. I went to each one of them. I even went to the judges who made decisions. The most recent decision was, we shall not investigate this. It will not be looked at. Like, that was what it said in the most recent judge's decision, that there's been a choice made. And it's documented now that you can read this decision.
Oh my
saying,
God.
This will not be pursued. This is done. And so, you know, the financial authority told me, oh, it's a criminal matter. Oh, it's a civilian matter. Well, at any rate, it's not our matter. You know, let the police deal with it. The police say, oh, no, the courts are dealing with it. The court says, we're not dealing with it. And so it shows you what happens when real money laundering is detected, if it's being investigated. Will the island really do something about it when there are allegations of these things happening? And just to give you like a little idea of what they found, there were a number of people's trusts found. And again, I found a Prince Andrew link, which I'm still looking at. But there was, it's a Colorado pornographer, and he was convicted of child pornography, holding child pornography and tax fraud. His name's Eddie Wedelstedt. A man named Ronald Furr, who I believe is in Israel, and he was linked to a lost Sandro Botticelli painting, the Madonna and Child painting, that went missing several years ago. Tanya, the woman and the couple, she right. said that that painting showed up in a trust that has her name on it that she didn't know existed.
Well, what do you know? That's just, how, you know.
I never could conceive of having a Botticelli painting, like let alone finding out I owned a trust that I never knew about that had the painting in it. But that's what happened to her. And Darren, her husband, said, we're finding car collections, doll collections. We're finding whole estates, properties, stuff all over the world. There's also quite a few different Russian billionaires involved, British billionaires, and people also here in the United States. And there are all these secrecy jurisdictions that are ruled into this trust company that was allegedly laundering money, but the fact is the documents clearly show laundering money.
Yeah.
So the last thing I wanted to mention about what they found and what we write about in the article is the fabrication of documents.
Oh yeah, I was going to ask about this because that was a good key detail. Yeah.
One of the most fascinating things about this is there are not that many places in the world that will totally fabricate something from scratch. Apparently, what was found at this manor, which is still there on Jersey, it's called St. John's Manor. What they found in St. John's Manor was not only old typewriters, old stacks of paper, old pens, old paper, old fax machines. These were all being used to generate old documents that looked as though they had unique and original provenance. And they even found instructions that were being passed around amongst the directors of the company about, don't forget to use the special old ink. Don't forget to use the special old paper. And the reason why they were fabricating documents was to create, in many cases, things like fake debt, fake bills of sale, fake accounts for various things. Because if you are gonna launder money and you're hiding money, a great way to do it is to create fake debt that is being fake paid.
Yeah.
So that money can just sort of disappear. And in the case of the Botticelli painting,
right.
what I think happened was that this person didn't want the painting to get caught up in a divorce, right? Where somebody was gonna sell it or get it. So what was created was a fake bill that the painting supposedly paid for. Therefore painting not part of the process anymore, right? But it appears that what happened was the painting was just stuffed away for a later date. But again, like this is what the documents show. All of the documents taken together have not been completely mined. And so the article is really about what we know so far and what efforts are being made to conceal the truth, which was just an amazing trip through all of these documents. It was exhausting, I might add.
It sounds tedious.
I didn't get sleep for weeks.
It's an excellent article. Like I said, the it's propulsive. The way that you write is sort of propulsive, and it's very, very good. Good, you know, it's fun to read, even though it's awful what you're writing about.
I want people to feel like they can understand these very tricky topics, because I don't consider myself. I mean, I don't even try to act like I'm a super genius. I don't even try, because I don't think that's the point. It's really about putting in really hard work, really good research, and then trying to write the story so that regular people can find it really interesting, really fascinating, and really learn something. So that's a huge compliment to me, because to me, you want any reader to be able to pick it up and say, wow, you know, I understand how money laundering works now, or I understand, a culture or a place or a situation that I've never imagined existed. And as a journalist, that's like what you want to do. You want to take people on a journey through new knowledge.
Well, you did a great job with the story and your work in general. Now, the talking of the fake documents reminds me of a story that I heard, which I think this is true. There was a famous counterfeiter at one point who was making crisp new, I forget what country's bills they were. And, you know, when money comes out, it's clean and pressed and uncirculated. So they need to... They needed to make it feel used. So they needed it to be handled by human hands, but they couldn't have people see. So they basically hired a bunch of blind people to just pass the notes around a table over and over again. And then that was it. That's how they solved the problem. Because, you know, they didn't know what they couldn't see what they were touching. And the notes got made circulated seeming. and it solved the problem in a very clever way. True story.
Oh my gosh.
From the counterfeiting files of
What people need to know about money laundering is it's literally just shuffling a bunch of stuff around within like a controlled environment to change the appearance of something, right? I mean, ultimately that's all that's happening. And when you really look at what took place whenever you're tracking money laundering, you start to realize it's almost ridiculously childish. Oh, we'll play hide and seek with, you know, a piece of art, or we'll play hide and seek with some documents, or we'll fabricate something. I mean, this is the kind of stuff, if you look at what they're doing, you literally are watching, in some cases you're getting documents where things are taped together with a fake stamp, you know, the stuff you would do if you were a fifth grader trying to fake a signature to your teacher from your mother. Like, that is what you will see as a journalist. And you think to yourself, I cannot believe grown men and women are behaving this way. I mean, as you said, maybe, you know, maybe being journalists, maybe we're the ones who are wrong. Maybe, you know, maybe this isn't the best way to make money or the fastest way to make money.
I don't know. I think we're
journalists, but
yeah, we're the wrong line.
I'd rather be on the good side.
I know. Yeah. The other side pays much better. As Rick says in Casablanca, when asked, you know, you were paid handsomely both sides. And he's, you know, both times, and he says, but the winning side paid much more.
Paid better.
Yeah. Okay. So I mentioned that this was the first piece by you that I was aware that you wrote, but I actually read something that you wrote years ago for Newsweek, which was trying to figure out who Satoshi Nakamoto was, the founder of Bitcoin. And yeah. You figured out, or you argued that the founder of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto, was actually a guy named Satoshi Nakamoto, which was very clever of you. And I remember reading it at the time thinking, oh, this is a great piece. And I read it again. I was like, oh, she wrote this. This is a great piece. And I know you caught shit for that article, which is fine. We don't need to talk about that. But I've asked people who have come on the show about Bitcoin, because honestly, it puzzles me. I had one of my first guests was Scaramucci. He came on and he's a big Bitcoin guy. And he was like, oh, no. Yeah. And he said, it has to succeed because Metcalfe's law says that anything that gets this big, there's too many people involved wanting it to succeed, and therefore it must succeed. And then I've had other people say it's tulip mania. Diane Francis said, no, this is tulips all over again. Asia Radin, my friend who wrote a new book called The Truth About the Lies, she's going to be on the show. She might have already been on the show, depending on when this episode.
The Truth About the Lies.
The Truth About the Lies says, no, that's just a scam. So what do you think? What's the deal with Bitcoin? What do you feel about it today?
I want to do the follow-up book called The Lies About the Truth. that needs to be her sequel. I do want to say, because you were trying to give me a little get out of jail free card there on the story that I wrote for Newsweek in 2014 about Bitcoin. I wanted to say, yeah, I still stand completely by that story. And in all respects, everything I reported, it was absolutely true to facts. After the story came out, I received all sorts of different communications. And as you pointed out, I took a lot of shit for it. For even, first of all, daring to try to write about who is the shadowy figure, et cetera. Did I mention it in the shadows, the shadowy figure? But the job of a journalist is to explore the world as we know it as best we can. And our job is not to help people hide in the shadows. It's just not part of the job. So, you know, if somebody wants to hide in the shadows, they should go talk to a money launderer and not to a journalist. But in this case, I got a lot of communications afterward that were useless. I did receive some communications that were very useful and added a lot of context to the original story with facts that I couldn't have had and wouldn't have had. But I do want to do a follow-up. There is more to the story. Okay. I actually have someone talking to me right now who just wants to do a documentary about this topic. And so, you know, I will find a way to tell the rest of the story as I know it. Bitcoin is one of those stories when it comes to the founder of Bitcoin and the group of people sort of surrounding the origin story, including all the early developers. It's a story that I think will only fully be told if you keep going, right? Like, yeah. I don't think there's going to be like one silver ball and everybody's going to have everything right away. I think it's one of those things where enough people still, some people do want to talk and some people don't want to talk. Until everyone is really heard from, you're not going to get all of it. But we do have some of it, and I hope to show some more of it. And so I don't want to just take a get out of jail free card on that one. I do want to say stand by all the reporting, and I hope to report more. And I hope those who have been in communication with me will allow me to report more, because some of them are still quite happy about being reporting. That being said, you're talking about the bloodbath today in Bitcoin?
I mean, it's cratering, but you know, that doesn't mean it's going to stay crater. It might be like the negative oil price and the real bit, like, are the Winklevoss twins worried today? Is Scaramucci worried? I don't know.
So I think Bitcoin's here to stay. I think crypto's here to stay. And I think it might be one of the most fantastic human experiments we've ever seen, because it is certainly one of the most devastating bull markets and bear markets either way, whenever it's doing its thing, that we have seen in human history. And so when I see it crash, I mean, it's not like it crashed. Just look at what it was doing a year ago. You know, like it's not like it crashed to.
It corrected.
So low. Yeah. So low that it's, you know, a colleague of mine from the Wall Street Journal wrote today on Twitter, Bitcoin is dead. And, you know, I'm so tired of the annoying drama. Like, it's not dead. It's not going anywhere. Yelling it's dead, or Elon Musk yelling something. The melodrama is now at this point, like, about as regular as a bowel movement, you screaming this way and screaming that way. It's getting really boring. So no, I do think it's here to stay. I don't know if I believe in the Scaramucci theory per se, but the idea of a digitalized and decentralized currency and the technology of the blockchain is obviously something that we want, right? If we didn't want it, we wouldn't be this far. So we absolutely want it. What are we gonna do? You know, it's not an easy situation, because you can have infinite coins, right? Like, we could make the, you know, the Oliar coin, like, right now, and it could just be out there in the world. Did I pronounce your name right?
You did. I'm very impressed.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I mean, we could make these coins. Somebody made a coin and put my name on it, which is bizarre. So I guess we don't know, every time it gets hyped, where's the energy going to go, right? Because it might go to one coin and then another coin. And I think a lot of new market participants don't know which way to invest. But I absolutely believe it's here to stay. And I think it's a really important technology. And most importantly, the philosophy behind Bitcoin when it started, which was, let's try to not be so reliant on centralized banking systems, right? You know, it was right in the wake of the credit crisis. And I believe in us trying to find other alternatives. Should we completely replace fiat currency? You know, will that ever happen? I think that might be a little too soon to talk about, but should we try to create decentralized options? Why shouldn't we try to do that? You know, why is that a bad part of this human experiment? I think for me, especially the philosopher in me, I just am excited about the possibilities and what's going to happen next.
It's going to be interesting for sure. And, you know, you were there writing the story, and I look forward to you following up on it. I hope that you're able to do that.
I hope I am too. You know, if people don't threaten me, I would love to finish it.
Leah McGrath Goodman, thank you so much for joining us. Where can we find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at @truth_eater. So it's Truth Eater with an underscore in between. And you can also find me at leahmcgrathgoodman.com, which is my website. You can see my stories there. You can leave me a note, and also my books.
The new book is called Arianne Huffington, Media Visionary and Wellness Evangelist. Leah McGrath Goodman, thanks again.
Thanks.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sofia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, and Ryan Byrne, History Falls Apart. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Visit gregoliar.com, GREGOLEAR.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. And don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.